you want to do that while you you can start?
I'll do it as part of the the experience.
All right.
So to speak, you know?
So our next presenter, how do you say your last name, Sean?
Sean O'Chestnut. Would you need a kind of a degree in Celtic studies?
Oh yeah, I need a degree in Celtic studies to pronounce Sean's last name. He's telling me Sean's been part of the Communio Circle for as long as we've been around in this diocese. So Sean O'Chestnut is the way I'm going to say it.
Beautiful.
Thank you. I'm part Irish.
You get a degree automatically for that.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Now, Sean is going to speak in the first person, a little bit like O'Malley, if I may be so bold. Is that fair to say?
Sure.
But from a Dominican,
honored company.
Yeah, but from a Dominican as opposed to a Jesuit perspective, and being in a house of formation during the council, which I'll go into in more detail, one of the things I think is a terrible loss, I'm speaking for myself, and this is actually one of the reasons we're here this morning, is this forgetting. I was born the year after the council ended, and I love the council, and I'm fascinated by how much difference it's made to all of our lives in the Catholic and the wider Christian community. But many people I know who are my age and younger have no idea that this is such a huge event in our church community. And I really have appreciated over the years that Sean has continued to share that enthusiasm of somebody who was paying attention and caught up in the work of the council as it was going on. And that's really, I think, O'Malley's perspective to a large extent. So we'll get a chance to hear in the first person, if I may say so, from Sean.
Thanks, Chair. Well, thank you for allowing me to speak to you here this morning. As you can see, we're in the process of distributing some more papers, and I'm deliberately making a thing out of this because I want to bring you to... I wasn't at the Vatican, at the Vatican Council when it was on. I did pop into the Vatican at the Synod of Bishops, not as a representative or a participant, but I happened to meet a Canadian cardinal. He's known as the Gentle Eminence Cardinal Flahef, who was fairly instrumental in me moving from the Vatican, so to speak, although that wasn't I was just visiting, to Canada. But one of the things that with the bishops at the council was the enormous amount of materials being presented to them, the schemata, on all the various topics from everything under the sun, from the whole of the theology, if you like, and religion. So that's why I was... You have some copies of some of the stuff that's in this, but I thought I'd put it together in a more compact version. So whichever version you like to look at, the boat's pretty much on track. I'm just going to help myself with the water.
Sean, it's on one of the table there.
Is there something?
Help yourself. Yeah, no, it's untouched on the brown table. Right in front of the podium.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And again, I find myself stating at the beginning of any talks I give that old phrase about angel, what's the phrase that goes, fools step in where angels fear to tread. Because especially following on Peter, who knows what he's talking about, I'm not an academic. And so I don't have that facility with recall and with precision about dates and names and things that Peter has demonstrated, and of course the tremendous insights that he's given us. But on listening to Peter this morning, especially as he held up the two books, the two, so you know, dimensions of the Vatican II, I thought to myself very presumptuously, maybe I'll get and unite those two books in the Dominican model, so to speak. So here goes. First of all, let me draw a diagram, just like Peter, because I learned a lot just from watching Peter. You know, he drew this line down here. And I'm going to put 1959 here. And I'm going to put 1965 here. And somewhere in here is 1962. And that's where we'd be focusing on that, because the question is, where were you in 1962? Or maybe more precisely, you may recall the year after, 1963, I think it was November the 22nd, where anybody who was alive at that time, the question was, where were you on that date? And I know Stephen is nodding his head, so maybe you could tell us about that date.
In the torque room at Waterloo Lutheran University, as it was then called, and somebody strode into the room and said, Kennedy's been shot.
Mm-hmm. And I was, I recall that. Does anybody else have recollections of that particular moment when the... Did you want to tell us about it?
That was very understandable. I was sitting at home. I was not working that day because I was homesick, watching TV when it came on.
Mm. And I was standing with my capuce, as they call it, the cowl up, and I'm ringing the bell for matins, although matins is normally in the morning time. I suppose the Cistercians, they get up at 2:30 in the morning to do the matins. But the Dominicans were very economic with time because they wanted to spend the time studying. And they didn't want to be getting up really, really early in the morning, because you need energy to study. So the Dominicans had their matins the evening before. So I'm ringing the bell for matins to bring all the brethren down. There's quite a huge community of students and priests and what we used to call lay brothers. And they were all making their way down the big cloister in Talla, County Dublin, for matins. When somebody whispers to me, Kennedy has been shot. And I remember that as vividly as Stephen remembers his recall and in yours. I very, again, when, thank you to Father Mark and to Deacon Charles and the Communio group for inviting me. It was very courageous on their part to invite somebody like myself. And I duly suggested that maybe we should have a different title. And this is the title I came up with, as you can see from the handout. Becoming Familiar with the Sacred, How to Grok Sacra Sanctum Concilium While Avoiding Moonbats and Wingnuts. From the vantage point of a young Irish friar in formation at the time of Vatican II. Now, I was Gerard in the order, so I call myself Frater Gerardus here. I want to start, though, with two readings from people who were there, who were actually there. I should mention, you might have noticed me coming in with my bags. I have them on display here. When I arrived in Canada in 1974, I arrived in Winnipeg, the airport in Winnipeg, and I had all my worldly goods with me. 10 bags. And I was also doing it on the cheap, because I had actually left the order at the time and I was on my own. And I had been given the fare to go to Canada. It was more or less, listen, Sean, go to Canada, you know. And I had the change out of that for my pocket money. And so I got the bus. Rather than get one of these expensive limousines from the airport, I got the bus, the transit bus, the Winnipeg transit bus, from the airport down to the Y. And got on the bus, and you know that long seat that you get inside, and I put my 10 bags there. And I said to the driver, could he drop me off near the nearest point to the Y? And he said, just sit there and I'll let you off. So he drives the bus. It's about 9:30, 10 o'clock. It's kind of darkish. And he stops the bus. He's downtown, and he says, this is not a bus stop, but he said, this is the best way to the Y. Through the laneway, and he said, I'll tell you what you'll do. Take five bags, put them at the thing there. He says, just around the corner is the Y. And then he says, I'll watch those bags, and then you take the other five and bring them into the Y. And then he says, you'll be right there. And that was the greatest hospitality one could imagine, arriving in a new country in North America. I had lived in the tropics in Trinidad, in an island, and I came from an island, but I'd never been on the continent, such huge things, and I never forget that occasion. So I'm still carrying the bags, as you can see, and I'm still reading the books. So let me just give you a couple of words from Schkillebeck's, writing his impressions of the first session, with a brief reading from this little booklet called The Struggle of Minds. And this harps back to what Peter was saying about the different opinions and different experiences. The way in which the first phase of the Second Vatican Council developed has surpassed the most optimistic expectations. It is undoubtedly true that constitutionally nothing has been decided, nor has a single conciliar document been definitively approved. Denzinger, that's the Encridion, or Denzinger is kind of a book of the Church's statements or doctrines or whatever, is as yet unable to adopt anything from this council. And yet I feel that it has already passed the turning point. We know, as we always have, that the dogmatic significance of a college of bishops spread out over the whole world is the same as that of a world episcopate gathered together in synod. But experience here in Rome has shown that psychologically and sociologically, these two manifest themselves in astoundingly different ways. Thoughts on the subject of the renewal and remodeling of the apostolate of the Church, which many a bishop in his see humbly kept to himself, are expressed only with hesitation and caution, were at first only whispered diffidently in Rome, until people discovered that practically all their colleagues were thinking the same way. A moral harmony found expression, which had been there all along, without being put into words. The mutual contact of bishops from so many lands and from all parts of the world released what had obviously for a long time been crying out for authoritative formulation. For that is precisely how we define a council. Alas, some are bound to see these happenings exclusively in the light or the darkness of the opposition, conservatism versus progressivism. They secularize what has taken place, though the worldly element is undoubtedly deeply embedded here. Even while the council was sitting, there appeared a book, and he goes on to explain about how this book was, he called it Certain Maurice Pinay, P-N-I-N-A-Y. In an extreme and absurd manner, the book reflects what at the time of the council was printed in some Italian newspapers as a clever maneuver to push through a reluctant, the Italian idea of a breakthrough. And there again, he's bringing us right to the scene, to the floor of the Vatican Council, where so many papers and documents and schemas were being presented, and so many documents were being presented to the bishops, some proposing and supporting the progressive side, if you like to call it that, some proposing for the conservative, and as Peter was saying about Octaviani versus Congar or whoever. There's another Dominican that I want to tell you about. And this is from Contemplation and Incarnation, the Theology of Marie-Dominique Chenu. Theological Optimism and the Grounds for Hope. Basically, this is from a person called Podwarski, and he's writing on, as I say, the Dominican vocation and contemplation. Chenu, he says in a text from 1934, this is way before the council, reflects on optimism as related to the very charism of the Dominican order. If I seek at the end of these conferences, he says, to rewrite the drama of our life, if an attempt to grasp the appearance of its architecture, well, the artist who contemplates his work sees not only its parts, but beyond these, something more subtle, something very spiritual which animates it all. If I want to set down in one word this impression, to grasp the spirit which animates our Dominican institution, it seems to me that I do not end up with this or that resolution. It seems to me that I end in an interior fulfillment, a security, a simplicity of soul. We have added one element to another, and yet all of this is very simple. We reconquer and we renew in ourselves that which makes at the core of our soul for Dominican optimism. It is surely that this word, it is this word that I would wish to end, he says. Well, I read that because I'd like to start with that optimism when it comes to the Vatican Council, because it was a very exciting time, as I mentioned in the handout there, to be a cleric at the time, to be a student of theology. And I have on page 2 of the handout, page 2, I have a dovetailing timeline, as I call it, of the Vatican Council and my own presence in the cloister and in the studium of the Dominicans, which parallels exactly the Vatican Council and my studies. Now, I just give that timeline to show the, if you might call it, the intimacy of being a student of theology when this was going on. But I have to say that I didn't necessarily represent the population of Ireland or the people of Ireland in that state, because the people in Ireland in the late 50s, 60s, you know, where Ireland was a very different place than it is today, although it seems to be heading back that way in terms of poverty and economies. I came across, I'll just give you a little picture of Ireland, as drawn by a writer at the time, John McGarren. He's the most, according to this book, the most perceptive observer of Irish internal and external lives in the 50s and 60s. remembers a country where reading for pleasure was thought to be dangerous. Goes on to say, time was filled by necessary work, always exaggerated, sleep, Gaelic football, prayer, gossip, religious observance, the giving of advice, ponderously delivered and received in stupor, civil war politics, and the eternal business that Proust describes as moral idleness. This was confined mostly to the new emerging classes, civil servants, policemen, teachers, tillage inspectors. The ordinary farming people went about their sensible pagan lives as they had done for centuries, seeing all this as one of the many veneers they had to pretend to wear, like all the others they had worn since the time of the Druids. And then this particular author of this book called The Boycott, The Feathered and Sea Boycott, which just came out last year, the self-appointed moral guardians were not confined to the countryside. They were active in the cities, cinemas and theatres too. In May 1957, Alan Simpson, the co-director of the Small Pike Theatre in Dublin, was arrested and jailed overnight on the grounds of indecency. What caused offence? One of the actors in the production of Tennessee Williams' The Rose Tattoo had pretended to drop a condom on stage. Catholic devotion took place in public in the 1950s Ireland. Being a good Irishman was inextricably linked to being a good Catholic. The people erected grottos to the Virgin Mary on urban housing estates, in rural villages, and at holy sites in the middle of the countryside throughout the Marian year 1954. The priest had exclusive moral authority. To go agin him took courage. The priest went to the front of the queue in the shop. The priest was given the best chair in the house. You did not say no to the priest. In this intellectually arid climate, it was easier to conform. To say no had all sorts of implications, metaphysically and socially. Condemnation from the pulpit was dreaded. I just read that again to give you, I know it spoke about the optimism that was prevalent in the order that I happen to be part of, but there wasn't that much optimism in the rest of the world. So I consider myself a privileged individual in many ways. In the Dominican formation, you went in and it was very much like being a Benedictine or a Cistercian. You didn't go home for holidays. You went to another location for holidays, but you never went home for the 7 years that you were studying. So it was a very monastic, very cloistered setting, and very removed from the world that I just described in the from this reading. In recent years, a sociologist has written an analysis of that time, and they're basically saying that. Let's see if I can find it here. That. Fuller is the name of a book called Irish Catholicism Since 1950, The Undoing of a Culture. Fuller is the author, sets out in roughly chronological order to describe and analyze the development of the Catholic Church in Ireland from the first hesitant stirrings of institutional change in the 1950s through Vatican II and its aftermath down to the 1970s. Although the book in many ways sets itself the task of the historical observer, how things changed over time, it goes a long way to giving some hints as to the why. Fuller places a great deal of emphasis on the first signs of engagement with continental developments. And this is what Peter was saying earlier about continental developments. The French theologians, for example, was very much an exclusive domain to to the general run of Catholics in Ireland at that time. And he mentions, the author mentions here, Louise, it's a woman, Louise Fuller says, especially, she said, the first signs of engagement with continental developments, and that also includes Vatican II, especially around the offices of the periodicals Doctrine and Life and the Furrow. She convincingly demonstrates that a conservative Irish church did not simply absorb the shock waves emanating from the council, but that at least in places was already thinking along the same lines for some years before. Now, Doctrine and Life, I'm happy to say, happened to be an Irish Dominican publication. So consequently, as a member of the Irish province, and as a student particularly, we had the editor and the contributors to Doctrine and Life very much in our ear, so to speak, about what was going on at Vatican II. So it was almost equivalent to being there. I'm going to keep the ball rolling here, so I'm going to go to the assignment that I was given, which was to give you some kind of review of chapter 4, the first period. The lines are drawn, pages 127 to 141. So if you go to handout page 3, you're probably wondering when is he going to get to this assignment. Well, here I am. But I've organized it in such a way that it'll save you all the reading in the world. You just have 10 simple points to remember: that there was one central figure, 2 liturgical movement pioneers, 3 moderating bodies, 4 regulations cardinals, 5 guiding criteria, 6 influential speakers, 7 immense schema, 8 sacrosanctum chapters, 9 supporting countries or continents, and 10 council commissions. That's all written out there for you in one page. Now, just for those who want to do the honors course, on page 4, I put in some notations, mainly taken from what John O'Malley writes in his book, What Happened at Vatican II. The one central figure, and again, I guess, for a lot of people, as Peter mentioned, Ottaviani would be the name, because I have to say, in my privileged position as a friar student in Tala, even though I'm in a cloistered environment, the names of the people at Vatican II were like household names to us. I knew the names of all of these cardinals better than I knew the names of my relatives, actually, because I didn't very see many of my relatives during that 7 or 8 years. Anyway, O'Malley tells us that Perical Felici was one of the central figures, a secretary general. As secretary general, he held an extremely important and sensitive position. He had been an assistant to Cardinal Tardini in the anti-preparatory stage of the council and won increasing respect and influence from that point forward because of his intelligence, energy, and organizational skills. And I think Father Mark reference one of the popes in association with Vatican I. So being an organizer was a very important attribute to have as a cleric if you wanted to go up the ranks, so to speak. That's why I never reached anything. I was ordained, but I never got beyond that, mainly because of my extraordinary lack of organizational skills. Then we have 2 liturgical movement pioneers. The liturgical movement, again, as Peter pointed out, there's a simplicity about saying, well, the liturgical movement, which was begun by, I guess, Benedictines, predominantly, and even people talk about the Benedictinism, so to speak, of Vatican II and of Sacrosanctum Concilium. I was going to say the Benedictinism versus the Dominicanisms, meaning the predominance of Dominican periti or experts. But we don't want to get into dividing the camps here. Anyway, the two liturgical pioneers that O'Malley mentions on page 71 and 74 were, and I have to beg your indulgence here, Prosper Guéranger, a Benedictine, could not have had a more conservative, restorationist, zealous, ultramontanist, and if Guéranger deserves credit for originating the revival of interest in the liturgy, the Belgian, Dom Lambert Boudon, deserves credit for launching the movement and promoting effective measures to bring it to Catholics in the pews. And here again, I'm just kind of putting together, so to speak, your conservative and your liberal. These labels are terribly ineffective and not very helpful in understanding the dynamic, but they're there. And there are three moderating bodies with blurred boundary lines, according to O'Malley, which was actually a blessing in disguise, because if it was rigid, then you might have had a different outcome, at least of the first session. It kind of was loose enough so as that people could run around the regulations and the regulators, so to speak, who were the Council of Presidents, that was 10 cardinals, but John the 23rd selected only one, Eugene Tisserand, another household name, from the Curia to be the head of that body. The Secretariat for the Extraordinary Affairs, 7 cardinals under Cicognani, Amleto Cicognani, as distinct from Gaetano Cicognani, 2 Cicognanis. This is becoming a family affair. Doesn't it look like it? 2 head guys for the council, brothers. But one of them actually died just before the sessions opened. But he was a very important figure because he had to sign the document to let it go to the bishops for voting. And according to, I think it's O'Malley tells the story about how his health was so bad, and the members of the commission for the liturgy were concerned that if he goes, this document which they've been working on, which was very much a progressive document, would fall by the wayside. So they got the brother to influence him, younger brother by about 10 years, I think, to influence the elder brother who's dying to sign this thing. And according again to the story, you see, I've grokked myself so much with Sacrosanctum Concilium, with all the books. I don't know whether I'm quoting from O'Malley or from the Rhine into the Tiber or from the famous Xavier Rin. But the story is there. It's a marvelous story. And as I say, I'm just giving you my assignment here is to tell you about the discussion of the liturgy. So I'm going to go on to the 5 guiding criteria. He listed 5 criteria that had guided the preparatory commission in drawing up the schema. First, the commission would exercise great care in conserving the liturgical patrimony of the church. Second, it would be guided by a few principles that would undergird a general renewal. Instauration, or maybe that's instauratio, and then the computer puts in the N, because that's what the computers do. They're very dangerous things. Change the whole meaning. Anyway, they undergird the general renewal of the liturgy. It would derive its practical and rubrical directives from a doctrinal base. It would insist on the necessity of instilling in the clergy a deeper sense of the liturgical spirit so that they could be effective teachers of the faithful. And finally, it would take its aim, leading the faithful into an even more active participation in the liturgy. Those, like, if all you take from this apropos Sacrosanctum Concilium, these five guiding principles, you couldn't get better. You couldn't get better principles than that. There were six influential speakers, according to O'Malley: Fringe, Ruffini, Lercaro, Montini, Spellman, and Doffner. And incidentally, the language of the council was Latin. Now you wonder, from a guy like me, who's just barely made it, like with, in order to get into the order at that time, you had to pass Latin. In fact, I was a month late starting because I had to redo my matric in Latin because I needed it to join the Dominicans. So my Latin is not excellent. In fact, it's non-existent at the moment. Although, this is where one of the very mysterious things about the council crops up. Because we're in the 62 here. What comes out? Only a document from John the 23rd saying everybody must learn Latin who's going to be in the priesthood, and that all the classes are going to be in Latin, classes in theology. So here was I, with that great optimism that the Dominican spirit allows, kind of hoping that Latin would be kind of dropped at the side, reinforced. And I'm saying to myself, I think John the 23rd is letting us down, because I like the guy. He's a very, you can see from his photograph and from his reputation, a marvelous, likable person. But here he is sending out this document in the middle of all the excitement about the new, the renewal, the new theology and the renewal of the liturgy, a Latin thing. So thanks to my teachers and professors at the Dominican Priory, they reassured us that this was simply a trade-off for John the 23rd to get other more important documents through the people we talked about, Octaviani and all those other, Tisserand wouldn't be there, the conservatives, if you want to call them that for want of a better name, and that he said, okay, I'll sign this Latin thing if you allow these other documents to go through. And that's the story. Now, I thought that was just a little kind of encouragement that my brother Dominicans were giving us as, you know, immature students, just to keep us encouraged. But I read recently, and I have to ask you again, G.Y., is that pronounced G or Gay? G. He's a Dominican. And he went down to Marquette, is that a university? Marquette. Just a few years ago, giving a talk, he was a member, an inside person, on the liturgical commission, and was actually a very well, great scholar and expert in liturgical matters. And he related to the folks down at Marquette that that was in fact the case, that John the 23rd traded in the signing of the document for Latin so as that he'd get some other more important stuff through. So we didn't worry too much about the Latin. There's a very interesting observation here in a concise guide to the documents of Vatican II, which I picked up in a store by Edward Hannenberg. That's not Father Ed, no.
Me?
Yeah. Talk for a minute. Anyway, it says here, the language of the council. The documents debated at Vatican II and the debates themselves were all in Latin. A simultaneous translation system for the council hall was proposed before the first session, but it never materialized. Much of the behind-the-scenes work of the council commissions and the informal discussion among bishops took place in modern languages, but the official speeches in the council hall were in Latin. This posed a real barrier for those bishops who, outside of the liturgy, hadn't used Latin since their days in seminary. And during the debate on the liturgy, the irony of this arrangement was not lost on many of the participants. They heard speeches composed in elegant classical Latin that advocated more use of the vernacular Mass. At the same time, they had to endure some speeches delivered in sloppy, elementary-level Latin that extolled the beauty and the virtues of this ancient language. So, makes you wonder, doesn't it?
Excuse me, Sean.
Time up.
Well, could you look at it different ways? Would you like to take a few questions? What would you like to do?
Sure. Maybe I need to explain myself a bit more. By all means, I invite you to question
or challenge. Because I think you shared a great deal with us about what it was like to be there at the time and some of the things that...
Yeah, that was the idea, too. I know I was bouncing around with different...
And we will actually... The next presentation, I think it's a good lead, and especially when you stop at the point on Latin, because I know Father Ed is going to pick up more specifically on the text of the document of the liturgy shortly. So if it's okay, why don't we just turn to a few questions or comments
Certainly.
For Sean. Thanks, Sean. Anyone have any questions or comments? Especially if you haven't had a few of us were speaking quite a bit before, which is great. Anyone else who hasn't yet? And certainly if you want to address something back to what Peter said earlier, it sort of ties in actually quite nicely.
Well, I tell you a good tip, Parents. Whenever you ask, have you any questions, what you do is you silently tap your toe for 30 seconds. And not say a word. So I was out to 10, so I have another 20 seconds before people to ask questions. There we are.
I have a sort of a nuclear countdown clock going towards Vatican III, and so with the new British missile, I've decided that Vatican III is going to happen about 15 years earlier than it might otherwise have happened. And now you just told me something that makes me think maybe I should go back a little, because... is the Vatican equipped to be able to do simultaneous translation for 2,000 people in the Basilica? Or would that be a thing that would cause 5 or 6 years of technical work to have to be done first before they could possibly manage to communicate to each other? Because I'd say the day of being able to talk in Latin is past. But.
Yeah. Although it seems to be making a comeback. It's a beautiful language, even though I'm not an expert in it. I find it very handy because there's always these phrases in Latin. They're good for what you might call your, what do you call those meetings, the coffee, cheese and wine and cheese kind of gatherings, you know, to throw out a Latin phrase here and there. Gives the impression that you're really in on the topic. And it's sometimes very helpful to describe something that's somewhat complicated in a very efficient way, because that's one of the advantages of the Latin language. It's used for legal purposes. It's a very succinct and very enlightening way of conveying a concept. I found myself actually in court recently, not for any misdemeanor on my part, but with a person I worked as a counselor at the working center, and he had a problem with the employment insurance situation of overpayment, so he wanted to bring it through to the court, the level of the court. And so he asked me, because he couldn't afford a lawyer, if I would kind of just go to the court with him and talk to the judge. So I thought I'd call on my Latin expertise in the absence of my legal abilities. And I asked the judge if he would consider epikeia, the virtue of epikeia, in order to judge this gentleman who was, you know, to being confused and confounded by the bureaucracy of the employment insurance system, if he would consider epikeia. And the judge was terribly impressed. He didn't actually allow the argument, but it was very impressive. And he treated me as if I was had a degree in law or something, or from the Supreme Court. It was quite exhilarating. So Latin can be very helpful, you know, in that sense.
Father Mark?
Thank you, Sean. I was wondering if you might respond to Peter's comment that as far as when you look at the development of the document, the question of the vernacular wasn't really a big deal, but yet that's what was sort of... became, I guess, in the popular minds, the big change. What was your sense of that? Like, when, at the time the document was coming out, was that the big change in terms of what people were talking about, or was there something else?
Actually, I think I'd have to concur with Peter's reporting on the thing that the Latin wasn't that predominant, you know? I mean, we did have, as students, we had this somewhat unease about a class in Latin. Well, we actually used to have our exams in Latin. We and I don't know how I survived it. I passed them all, and it's a miracle to this day how I passed them. But that was, again, using the right words, the right terminology. Just on, not to sidetrack your question, Father Mark, but I remember at that time very clearly going in, we had to do two exams. We had to do one for the Dominicans and one for the diocese in order to get what you call your faculties and for your minor and major orders. So because my Dominican professors were very much in line with the, I don't want to call it the new theology, but they were certainly, it may have been taught by Congar, or certainly knew Chenu. A lot of them studied in Le Sochoir, and so they had a line, an ear, as so to speak, with the Vatican and with the Hariti and with all the goings-on. So we were given, during our training time in our classes, drafts of the document, probably the drafts that the bishops got, to be up to date in theology, especially about Revelation. That's why the next part of that chapter is about the sources of Revelation, and again the verbum. Is it Verbum Dei? The final document.
Dei Verbum.
And I remember very clearly, as I can remember yesterday, going to, this is 62, 63, so we're still in this area. I want to sound like Peter now. You know, we're still in this area. I go to do the exam. So in order to go to the diocesan exam, you couldn't mention the schemata or the drafts or the possibilities of developments in theology. You had to give the manual answer. We had Tanqueray. We had a bunch of Tanqueray's. They were kind of sitting in the corner.
That's like a gin, or isn't that a kind of gin? It's a famous book. Yeah. Maybe not everybody knows who Tanqueray is.
Oh, Tanqueray, yeah. It's a manual. Yeah. It's a manual, yeah. It's not a liquid thing. So we'd all get these out of the cupboard, you know, before we'd go to the exams, and they'd been used for years and years. And you had to give the answer. That's where, you know, the answer, that's maybe how I passed the exam, because it was a fixed answer. You didn't have to work through, various opinions or speculations. No, just the answer, you know, like the catechism, except it was in Latin. So I decided, being a kind of a lazy student, that what's the point in learning two different things about the same subject? So I said, I'll stick with the Dominican thing, you know. And the question at the time, if I get it right now, they talk about it in the book there, the fontibus revelationis, the sources of revelation. And we were told by Father Liam Walsh that, you know, there are two channels and one source. Like, there was a certain subtlety, if you like. Now, I hope I'm getting him right. There were two channels and one source. But I think the Tanqueray answer, now I'd have to look it up again, but that is that there's one source or something of whatever. I forget the thing now. But anyway, I went and gave the Dominican answer and not the Tanqueray answer. And I could see it was a panel of three clerical people, all diocesan professors. And they didn't look very happy with my venture into Vatican II before it was, you know, even decided. So I got the impression that this, I would be coming back to repeat this exam. So when I asked my student master, like, any results yet, and he said, oh yeah, we got them, everybody passed. Oh, I said, that's a relief. He said, well, actually, there was a note on your performance that you need to improve your Latin.
Sean, yeah. That might be a good place to take a little break. What
sure.
do you think? Is that okay?
Absolutely. The okay. other thing is, there's a lot of material there that you could read at your leisure, so to speak, and then you can actually grok Sacrosanctum Concilium, because, as you know from grokking, I gave the very convenient dictionary at the beginning.
Yeah.
It's to get involved intimately with a subject. And as you can see, I've been so involved in it that I've actually lost the point of the whole
thing. Thank you very much, Sean. So in about 5 minutes, stretch your legs, take a little break, and Father Ed will get more specifically into the text of Sacrosanctum Concilium and relating to our new translation.